Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. I'm great. Thank you very much. I'm in Charlottesville still for one more week, but I will be back at the beginning of next week, and we will record next week's episode together again.
Excellent. All right. So
should I sing Reunited?
I think we'll lose a lot of listeners if you do that. So.
Okay. All right.
I mean, I've never heard you sing, Frank, honestly, so maybe you're really, really – it's a hidden talent.
It's
right.
Totally
right. So earlier this week, the nation and the world mourned, or at least much of it did, at the untimely death of L.A. Lakers star Kobe Bryant, who died in a helicopter accident. I believe it was on Sunday. Is that right?
It was Sunday morning, I think, California time.
And along with his daughter and seven other passengers and the person piloting the helicopter. And I think both of us were sort of struck by the public response to Kobe Bryant's death. And so what we thought we would do in today's show is try to think about, okay, what kind of historical antecedents do we have for the death of a celebrity figure like Kobe?
Yeah, I think it should be said, David, that we are excluding sort of political assassinations and things like that. I think when we were discussing this both online and before off air, was in terms of thinking about those moments, those deaths that seem to really touch the public in particular ways that are not political.
Yeah.
Well. Often the ways people respond are political. Almost, if we've learned anything, it's everything is political. But we're not talking about the deaths of political figures in the main, although one of the ones we're going to discuss is a politician. But rather, I guess I think you've described it well. We're talking about celebrities, but celebrities whose, I guess, celebrity is so widespread and so profound that their sudden deaths really resonate in ways basically unlike the deaths of others. And I think we saw a little bit of this on Sunday and Monday, and it's ongoing in Southern California in response to Kobe Bryant's death. I think Bryant's death and the response to it is complicated because his legacy is complicated, and we may well get to that, why it's so controversial. But this was a way for us to think more generally about the deaths of celebrities in American culture.
Yeah, so thinking about, you know, the first thing that occurred to me with Kobe Bryant's death and thinking about the ways in which people respond to it is that there are, in modern America, you know, tropes about what happens when a young celebrity dies. And those, I think, have been the sort of modern practice, I think, starts really in the 1950s and early 1960s, you know, if we're trying to sort of find a sort of origin story for this kind of cultural practice. You know, and the three celebrity deaths that jumped out to me as really being sort of the foundational ones would be the actor James Dean, who died at the age of 24 in 1955 in a car accident. Buddy Holly, who died in 1959 in an airplane accident. And Marilyn Monroe, who died in 1962 at the age of 36 from overdosing. I mean, what struck me about sort of that particular moment and the reason why we have a kind of celebrity cult death culture, if that's the right phrasing for it, you know, is you need to have somebody who is dying relatively young, right? Part of what was tragic about Kobe Bryant's death and other modern celebrities is when I think we mourn differently when a celebrity dies at an advanced age than when a celebrity dies either in sort of in the middle of their career or like Kobe shortly after his retirement. You know, James Dean was 24. He'd only made a handful of – I think he'd made three movies, Holly.
He'd made three movies. That's right.
Buddy Holly was 22, you know, and so we think of him as a really critically important figure in the development of popular music. But, you know, his playing career was quite short, you know, and so it's that sense of possibility and that sense that there was some, you know, the unfulfilled potential that was there. That's part of the story and the sort of the mythology that gets attached to it. But I think you also have to have a kind of celebrity culture that and a mass celebrity culture and modes of talking about celebrities as people who not only create things that people enjoy, but people have a sense of ownership over them. You know, I think the reason why people mourned James Dean was less about how much they loved those three movies and more about the ways in which they gravitated towards him as a symbol and an icon and a, you know, a sex symbol and all these other kinds of things.
Yeah, I was going to say, David, let's not beat about the bush. You know, sex symbol is an important part of that, especially the three archetypes you've talked about. Two of them, at least, in Marilyn Monroe and James Dean, you know, were famous in part because of their sex appeal.
And not only their sex appeal, but, you know, like there was the idea of a celebrity culture in which people are interested in their private lives and their relationships and what have you. And if you think it about other celebrities who've died early, died young since then, you know, a lot of those same tropes were a big part of that, you know, and it has to do with the role of television and the role of newspapers and magazines. It has to do with, I think, the rise of youth culture a lot. I mean, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about the 1950s in particular is a rise of a distinct teen culture, a youth culture that is different from what children do and different than from what older people do, and that the sort of culture of the celebrity, I think, is tied in with that. So I think there's something about that moment that creates the framework that I think we're still in for people like Kobe Bryant.
Well, although, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, although one thing we've seen in the past 20 years, or really if you think about with regard to Kobe Bryant, what was striking to me was he was only 41. I thought, my God, this man's been a celebrity for a long time. But, of course, he went into the NBA straight from high school.
Right.
So he had a 20-plus year playing career, but he was a prominent celebrity for a very long time from a very young age. So on one hand, there was his relative youth. But I think the media environment during his lifetime has actually changed quite considerably. So I think you're absolutely right that that post-war rise of mass entertainment and a mass media made celebrity possible, and thus we see those early figures as kind of archetypal celebrity deaths. But we've had a fracturing of the culture in all kinds of ways in the past 20 years, and we've sorted ourselves in all kinds of ways in terms of what television we watch and what music we listen to. We're no longer having those kind of common moments to the same extent. And so it might be rarer now that we get people whose demises, like Kobe Bryant's, really kind of speak across the culture. And in Bryant's case, it might be because, okay, he was primarily famous as an athlete. He'd kind of maintained his fame since his retirement several years ago by his presence and his involvement in the media. He was involved in Hollywood. He was very prominent in promoting women's athletics, particularly via his daughter Gianna, who died, but also the WNBA. And so he maintained his presence across multiple media formats in a way that I think it's more difficult for celebrities to do today. So I don't know what is difficult to know is whether these kinds of transcendent deaths will continue to happen because of the kind of fracturing of our popular culture.
Yeah. I think the fact that he played for LA matters. I mean, I think about sort of they just had the Grammys and the ways in which the Los Angeles popular culture scene sort of used that as a site of mourning for his death.
That's right.
It would have been different if he had played for Detroit or played for some other sort of small market team.
Yes, he might have been a very famous basketball player, but not a kind of global brand the way he became.
Right.
So it's difficult. One of the themes that runs through our conversation today is that in order for one of these deaths to be, for lack of a better word, transcendent and really permeate the cultures, the individual concerned has to have achieved a level of celebrity. But really, you're not just, okay, you're a very good athlete and you're known locally. You know, Kobe Bryant transcended just being a basketball player, I think.
I think they have to be somebody that people have an emotional connection to beyond a recognition of the quality of the work that they're doing. And I think so. Part people felt something, a connection with Brian. I didn't particularly, but I know lots of people did.
No, I didn't either. So in part, I look at this almost as a cultural anthropologist.
Yes.
Like, wow, it's weird the way people are responding to this, because this is a person who, in many respects, was deeply problematic. And again, we may get to that. But the reaction, it reminded me. I mean, I arrived in Edinburgh in the summer of 1997. And when we moved to Edinburgh from England, that was exactly the moment when Princess Diana died in Paris. And we were due to have brunch with one of my new colleagues who'd invited us over. And he called to cancel because he said it's just not appropriate now. And I thought, okay. And the outpouring of grief internationally in response to Diana's death was, I mean, I think Diana's death is probably the best example of this in recent times. And it kind of passed me by. I mean, it was sad this relatively young woman died and she left two small children. And but the way people responded kind of personally to it was really quite striking. And I think there was a measure of that, that there has been a measure of that type of response in response to Kobe Bryant. But I have to confess, you know, I didn't like Kobe Bryant very much, and I wasn't all that interested in what he had to do. And I think because of his legal troubles, which were pretty significant, I didn't find him a very compelling figure. That's not to say that the grief that people are feeling right now isn't palpable and quite profound.
Yeah, I basically had the same read on him that you did. The rape accusations that he had 20 years ago are still, I think, and that's clouded the. It's had an interesting sort of valence on the way his coverage of his death has played out in different media outlets. Obviously, I saw him as a very talented player, but he also took a lot of shots that he shouldn't have taken and passed the ball a bit more.
There's a very interesting essay. The best thing I read this week about Bryant's death was written by Charles Pierce in Esquire, and it was a thing that was going around. And Pierce wrote about trying to reconcile the rape accusation and the way that case played out. And if you read the legal documents, you know, it does, you know, read his apology, and I'm using apology, but I'm definitely using air quotes now, Bryant's apology. It's tough reading. And what he acknowledges there, I mean, it's hard to believe his PR people would have written such a document in today's Me Too moment. But anyway, with regard to consent and things like that, Pierce writes about, well, we have to reconcile what he did on the court with what his legal problems off the court, but also the way he lived his life since that moment, particularly with regard to his support for women athletes and so on. And it was the most balanced, basically sensible thing I've read. I will say one thing about Charlie Pierce. He wrote possibly the best obituary I've ever read, or tribute to somebody who died, when Levon Helm, the drummer and lead singer for the band, died.
Sure.
God, 7 or 8 years ago now, it must be. He wrote a brilliant essay, which I would recommend to everybody to find. You want Charlie Pierce to write about you when you die. That's what.
All right. Well, I'm hoping that he's not writing obituaries when I die. But yes.
It's a very brief essay about Bryant. It deals with a lot of these kind of ethical issues in a very, I thought, sophisticated way.
Did you have any? So, you know, I guess neither of us were particularly moved by Bryant's death beyond the sort of way that we are, how many public figure passes. Was there anybody any celebrity whose death did have an impact on you?
You know, not yet. I mean, I'm older than you, David, but don't recall any of the deaths you began those kind of.
Well, no, I'm. I wasn't.
No, I'm thinking since then. Okay, because if you think about the ones in our, basically in the since Marilyn Monroe died, and Buddy Holly and James Dean. So I think you're absolutely right that those are kind of the archetypes for us. Since then, so you have, what have we had? We have Michael Jackson. I didn't particularly like Michael Jackson. He, like Kobe Bryant, has a complicated legal and ethical legacy. So Michael Jackson's death didn't affect me in any meaningful way. I guess you know, Selena, the Tejana singer, who died in 1995. And again, that didn't personally affect me, although it seems to have had that kind of impact.
John Lennon?
You know, I'm going to tell you this. Don't tell the listeners. I don't really care for the Beatles.
Wow.
So, I mean, I just don't.
You don't like the Beatles? You're not a big fan of Burns' poetry? You might get kicked out of this country, Frank.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're fine. But I remember being shocked by John Lennon's death, certainly. And I do have a distinct memory of that, and that was when I was a teenager. But I didn't. It didn't affect me. And Elvis a couple of years before didn't really affect me. And no, I mean I haven't encountered a celebrity. When Bob Dylan dies, I think I'll be upset. But Bob Dylan's really old.
Old, exactly. The fact that Bob Dylan's still alive is actually more of a
is the miracle.
Yeah.
So it's different when somebody. I think you're right. I think age has something to play in this. I have yet to be really kind of profoundly moved by a celebrity death. What about yourself? What about Thurman Munson for you?
Thurman Munson died when I was like 4, so no.
Right, okay.
Remember, I'm a whole lot younger than you.
Yes.
I would say Kurt Cobain's death actually mattered to me.
Right.
Because that was when I was in high school. And when you're in high school, these kinds of things matter. And I knew. I mean, it wasn't just I enjoyed their music just like everybody else did, but. There were people who wore all black for the next month. Now a lot of them were wearing all black beforehand, but that was a sort of a point of at least generational mourning that was significant.
I think if you talk about if we talk about celebrity culture as being a version of teen culture or youth culture, then I think I think you put your finger on something. It's people who died when you were a teen, or people whose fame was impacted you when you were a teenager.
I
think a lot of the people who are mourning Kobe Bryant's death right now probably began following him when they were teenagers.
And yes, I think that's probably true.
Kind of 30s, and it's profoundly affecting them. But none of my teen idols have died suddenly, and now I'm at an age where you're expecting them to die, and it's the natural order of things. So I just haven't been affected by a celebrity death, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is very different when they die of natural causes at old age. So let's jump back to the pre James Dean era.
Yes,
because we were both trying to think of what are the historical antecedents for this. And there aren't as many, between the two of us, I don't think we could think of that many historical antecedents that really fit into this sort of topology of somebody who is a celebrity, part of mass culture, and dies and has a public response to it in the same way that, say, Kobe Bryant's death did. And I came up with 4 from the early 20th century and the 19th century. I'm going to maybe sort of go through these in sort of reverse chronological order just for going back from James Dean. 2 that struck me from 1926. First, Harry Houdini's death.
Right.
And he died at the age of 52, so he wasn't super young, but he was still, at the height of his performing career. And he has a very sort of interesting story about his death. He died of a burst appendix, but there's a dispute about exactly how he died. The story goes basically that two guys visited him in his dressing room. Houdini, who was famously in amazingly good physical shape, would sort of let people punch him in the stomach just to sort of demonstrate that he could take a punch or something. One of these guys punched him, and supposedly Houdini was not prepped for being punched and bruised him pretty badly in the abdomen. Either that punch ruptured his appendix or the punch triggered enough pain where Houdini became aware, or the doctors became aware of the ruptured appendix, but he died shortly thereafter. And so he gets mourned as a, world's greatest magician at the height of his, at the height of his powers, if you will, after doing years and years and years of extraordinarily dangerous stunts of suspending himself upside down with straitjackets underwater and all these other kinds of things that he would do. But the other death in 1926 that I think actually has more in common with this kind of celebrity trope that we've been talking about is the death of Rudolph Valentino at the age of 31. And he was one of the most famous silent movie actors, Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, The Sheik, Blood in the Sand, number of other films. And one of the things you see, I think, in the 20s that's sort of like the 1950s is you have this kind of rise of celebrity culture with magazines and tabloids of various kinds that chronicled not only the culture that these artists created, but their sort of lives behind the culture. So his love life was always in the news, you know, and he was sort of one of the first national sex symbols, you know, which requires a kind of mass media to kind of create. And he died, he collapsed, again, as I mentioned, at the age of 31 in a hotel in New York. He's sent to the hospital and dies a couple of days later. And one of the things that's striking about him is that his when he has this funeral, 100,000 people show up for his funeral in New York City. Then they take his body on a train, take it to L.A. where he has a second funeral. And so he's sort of his sort of a prototype for the kind of mourning rituals you find with James Dean. I think those are two sort of analog kind of figures.
You know, I think the young movie star sex symbol, you know, as I said, who dies young, I think that's a crucial element to this, yeah.
He becomes sort of fictionalized in one of John Dos Passos' novels, The Big Money. And so I think that sort of speaks to the kind of cultural cachet that his death had. When you get back to the 19th century, you don't have that. I had a really hard time thinking of people who fit into this mold. And the only two I could come up with, and I'm sure there are others, but and listeners, write in if I'm missing some obvious cases here, was the actor Tom Thumb, whose real name was Charles Stratton, but nobody went. His stage name was Tom Thumb, who performed with P.T. Barnum. He was of famously short stature. He's under 3 feet tall. But he toured. He was really one of the best known actors in the entire country, if not the world. He performed in front of Queen Victoria, who loved him. Abe Lincoln loved him. He had a he had a celebrity wedding during the middle of the Civil War that people stopped paying attention to the Civil War to pay attention to his wedding. And he dies in 1883 at the age of 45. He has an unexpected stroke. And 20,000 people attended his funeral in New York City, which, again, I think sort of speaks to that kind of celebrity. But you really don't have the same kind of celebrity culture in the 19th century that you do in the 20th century. But, you know, I think Tom Thumb represents sort of a prologue. You know, people are interested not only in his performance, but also in his personal life. He and his wife, for instance, who was also of a similar stature. You know, they had a child together and people cared about the child. Turns out the child may or may not have actually been their child. It's a complicated backstory, but you know, he was a celebrity in an era before there were many celebrities. And the other 19th century example I could think of was Sam Patch, who I know you are also a big fan of. Sam Patch, I guess, is largely forgotten now, although there's a great book about a couple of actually books about him. Was famous for jumping off of tall structures, off of bridges, off of buildings, off of towers next to waterfalls. And he died in front of huge crowds. He dies in 1829 at the age of 22, and one of these jumps didn't go so well. But I guess, you know, he's living in an age when there aren't a whole lot of celebrities. Do you have any thoughts about?
He's an early celebrity because he's basically a daredevil, isn't he? And he, as you say, he's famous for jumping off things and over things and so on. And he dies making one of these jumps. I think, if memory serves, he's in Rochester, New York,
on Friday the 13th.
Yes, that's right. And people thought, in fact, it might have been part of the show, as it were, because he was a showman, and thousands went to his funeral. So he's an early American celebrity, but he doesn't achieve. I mean, he's famous locally, and he's famous for a brief period of time. I think he's more in the Kardashian level of fame, in the sense of that he's a celebrity and he's famous for being famous. But the culture of the time, maybe it didn't allow for true celebrity. But I was just thinking, you know, the real celebrities of mass culture and popular culture in the 19th century are probably novelists, the people who are writing for, you know, newspapers, you know, who write these long serial novels. Dickens is probably the most famous. And, you know, when Dickens dies in 1870 at age 58, you know, that's a big deal. Again, globally, not or on both sides of the Atlantic, not just in the not just in Britain, but the celebrity culture doesn't operate the same way. I mean, I think this proves your larger thesis as you were working backward. I mean, I think, you know, both Houdini and Valentino are you know, they're made famous to some extent by film.
Yeah.
Not particularly Valentino, but film as a medium to reach a larger audience, and that kind of the technology doesn't allow for that kind of celebrity in the 19th century. I came up with, again, if we're working our way backwards, two examples that I think are really interesting in the 18th century. One barely in the 18th century, and this is our one politician on our list, and that's the death of George Washington in December of 1799. I mean, Washington was not young. He was 67 years old when he died. He did die suddenly, though, of a bacterial infection.
Didn't he have a really bad sore throat, and then they gave him mercury?
His treatment did not go well. But Washington was, apart from being a political leader and a military hero and all that kind of stuff, he was a genuine celebrity on both sides of the Atlantic, but especially in the United States. And he was retired at that point, but his death did trigger an outpouring of grief that was truly across the country. You know, in the 18th century, people didn't, you know, do the same thing as like the people who were leaving Kobe Bryant jerseys outside the Staples Center in Los Angeles right now, but they did the equivalent of that for the 18th century. So there were, kind of funeral orations held around the country. There were memorial services held around the country. There were hundreds of newspaper articles that people had written and pamphlets and things like that and observances of his death. So I think Washington's death in 1799 is a precursor to this in that it was more than just the death of a politician. I mean, famously, a generation later, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson will die on the 4th of July, 1826. And that's interesting because they died on the 4th of July, and it was the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the event with which they're most closely associated, and which most of their fame derives from. And people thought, oh, that's interesting, and many people interpreted that in a kind of providential way. But those were seen as the deaths of politicians, and they were interpreted through a partisan light, whereas Washington's death was different in the sense that seemingly the entire country mourned George Washington's death in 1799. The other one I think is really interesting, and I think he's the first American celebrity in the way that we're using the word, is the death of the English Methodist preacher George Whitefield in 1770 in Newburyport, Massachusetts.
That's a big jump between Whitefield as American celebrity to Marilyn Monroe and James Dean. But okay.
Yes. Google George Whitefield. Sexy he is not. But Whitefield was an incredibly compelling and inspiring preacher. There's a famous scene in Benjamin Franklin's autobiography where Benjamin Franklin, who's famously skeptical about religion, says he's going to hear Whitefield to hear him speak in Philadelphia. And as Franklin tells this story, and it's a very Franklin kind of story, well, I wasn't going to give him any money because I thought this was all nonsense. Well, I was, and I just wanted to see him perform. I was interested in the performance. I was so impressed with his speaking and how he could project his voice and how many thousands of people he was speaking to. I thought, I'll give him some money. Then, as the story unfolds, Franklin ends up giving him all the money he's got, you know, in his pockets. Whether that's true or not, or it's a, you know, Franklin story, it's typical of the kind of the accounts we have of Whitfield's oratorical brilliance. I mean, Whitfield was the first kind of televangelist in America, if you will, obviously before television. And it's estimated he spoke to, I mean, he constantly traveled around colonial America and in Britain. He crossed the Atlantic many times. It's estimated by one of his biographers he spoke to as many as 10 million people. That seems a little high to me, but
well, considering the population at the time, that's really
amazing. Yeah, that's too high. But he was able to. He was a genuinely popular and very well known figure in the middle decades of the 18th century on both sides of the Atlantic, and he was particularly. And we don't have to get into the religious history of 18th century America. We want to keep our audience, but he's a genuinely important figure in the religious history of colonial America. But he also becomes a celebrity, and on the basis of his performing ability, his ability to perform. When he dies suddenly in Newburyport, Massachusetts. When he's on tour, he's the first rock star. He dies in Newburyport in 1770. In 1775. When the when soldiers from the Continental Army are getting ready to invade Quebec, they actually open Whitfield's crypt and they take portions of his clothing with them.
Jeez.
As kind of talismans, you know, and which is interesting because these are kind of fundamentalist Protestants going to attack Catholic Quebec in order to bring it into the American fold. And their behavior is not unlike that of crusaders during the
taking relics or something. Yeah,
taking relics with them. So, they basically cut up what's left of his the clothes from his moldering body in the grave to take with them when they invade Quebec in late 75, early 76. And so I think that's testimony to Whitfield's celebrity. Whitfield is probably the least known of the people we're discussing on this list, and he's certainly not as well known. As George Washington will be, but I think there are two 18th century antecedents which are interesting. I think you're right. I mean, I think the list you've come up with is quite good. I think the key in explaining the subsequent celebrity deaths, if you will, or why they resonate, I think you're right. It's mass culture. It's the rise of a popular culture that kind of extends across the nation, makes that possible. And as I said, I do wonder whether Kobe Bryant might be one of the last of these because of the way the culture is going. We may not see, in the same way that, you know, we all have our own you can basically create your own TV station, you know, on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or whatever you're watching. And not everybody, we don't all watch the same things anymore. So I wonder if we'll still have the same, the same response to future celebrity deaths.
Well, one of the things that struck me in doing the research for thinking about this show is I was trying to think, okay, which American figures had the most people show up for their funeral, if that's an indication about their sort of place in society. And obviously we mourn differently today because you can mourn without actually going to the funeral. But in terms of thinking about which figures are going to get those kinds of attention. You know, and Lincoln obviously had a huge number of people who saw his sort of funeral train because he dies in Washington and then is buried in Illinois, and they had various like sort of repeat funerals along the way. Grant had a huge funeral in New York City, but the other sort of mass attended funerals in the late 19th and early 20th century. In the United States are the a funeral for the men executed as part of the Haymarket Affair in Chicago. So there's four guys who are executed there, and 500,000 people show up for their funeral, remembrance ceremony event. And a similar kind of thing happens with Joe Hill, the labor activist who was also executed in 1915. And he's, you know, relatively young when he's executed, and as were the men in Chicago. And it strikes, we get this point, we get this transitionary phase from being the people that we mourn in public are politicians to being the people that we mourn in public are celebrities, and celebrities of displaced politicians as being the subject of public mourning. I mean, I can imagine that, when Jimmy Carter dies, for instance, there'll be a lot of public mourning about him, but it's probably actually won't be as much as when Kobe Bryant died, in a way. Or at least you have a different character, I think. And so I think that says something about the kind of celebrity culture that has arisen in the United States and the ways in which politics had functioned in various points in time as a kind of mass culture, and the ways in which it popular culture has and celebrity culture has displaced that.
I agree with you to a point. I mean, in terms of some of the examples you gave, obviously some of those funerals became more than funerals for the individuals, but also political protests.
Exactly. Yeah. They're about this, what these people symbolized, right? Yeah.
Right. So Joe Hill or the Haymarket, or the men accused in the Haymarket bombing. Look, when Jimmy Carter dies, I mean, Jimmy Carter is in his 90s. He's had health problems. He's a very, very admirable figure. It's not going to be a tragedy when he dies.
That's true.
And Jimmy Carter was never a kind of wildly popular figure, and in the true sense of popular, in the sense of having a mass following. I mean, he's greatly admired. I think there will be an outpouring of grief when he dies, but I don't think. I think you'd see something very different if, you know, we woke up tomorrow and Barack Obama had died suddenly.
Yes, example. I think that's right. Yeah.
I think that would be very, because we would be shocked, we would be saddened in a slightly different way, and I think there would be a mass outpouring of grief among the many people who admire President Obama. So I think the age of the decedent matters.
Yeah, so I think that matters a lot, right? I think, yeah. Getting back to sort of the earliest points, it has to do with sort of potential and the loss that what could have been had they lived.
That's right. I mean, that's one of the reasons, and I know we ruled out assassinations, but why Kennedy's death resonates, John Kennedy's death resonates in a way that the deaths of other political figures don't necessarily. And one could almost bracket, and I know we ruled out political assassinations, I did, but you could almost see the deaths of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King alongside those, you know, the deaths of Buddy Holly, James Dean, and Marilyn Monroe in a very different way. But, you know, those were all men who were relatively young at the peak of their careers, but hadn't yet fulfilled all of their potential yet.
They had a kind of a celebrity to them that was above and beyond the ways in which American politicians of a generation before were public figures.
Well, we're back to, okay, in an age of mass culture, these were all good-looking, charismatic men.
Who were on television all the time and, yeah, all those things.
Yeah, so I think that that's a key element to this. So I don't know, I hope he lives has many, many more decades of good health and activity. But I think possibly President Obama is the only person who I can think of who might generate that kind of response. And, of course, let's not forget the millions who hate him. I mean,
true.
It won't be an unambiguous legacy when he dies.
That is to be sure. Yes, as with a number of other public figures that I'm not going to mention now. Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. Can you think of another current active celebrity whose death would generate a kind of mourning on this scale? Obviously not.
No. I was just thinking through the sort of list I'm not as in keen on celebrity culture maybe now as I was when I was 17. We're asking the wrong people about.
We're undoubtedly asking the wrong people.
The wrong people. We're two middle-aged men talking about celebrity. We don't know what we're talking about.
If you think about athletes, for example.
Yes.
Arguably, you know, somebody like Tom Brady is greater at his sport than Kobe Bryant was at his. Michael Jordan was probably the greatest basketball player of all time. Wayne Gretzky is regarded as the greatest hockey player of all time. When they die, the people who follow those sports will be saddened, I'm guessing, but it won't have the same kind of resonance.
I don't think it will.
For whatever reason, you know, there's a particular kind of set of circumstances that have to come together, and a lot, it's down to luck in many cases. So I can't, your silence was eloquent because I can't think of anybody else who's likely to generate that kind of response.
I'm most eloquent when I'm silent. That's my apex of my eloquence. All right. I guess it's a time for last drops. What you got?
I want to endorse something called the Historical Marker Database.
That sounds exciting. Tell me about the Historical Marker Database.
It's a database that allows you to see historical markers, particularly, you know, road markers and things like that, of historical that commemorate historical sites near you, especially in the United States. But it is an international database, so they do have international sites as well, particularly in the UK and in Canada, but not just. And you can sort of let it, if you let your phone or laptop, if you allow it to identify where you are, it can tell you historical markers near you. The reason I used this most recently was because I'm in Charlottesville. I wanted to find the site where Thomas Jefferson went to school. He went to school with this man named James Maury. It's about 14 miles from where I am, and I was able to find it over the over the last weekend because I used the Historical Markers Database. But once you get into this thing, it's a great way to get lost because you can sort by the historical period you're interested in. You can just see all the markers near you. I used it when I was in Nashville last year and found all kinds of sites related to the history of country music that were fascinating. Anyway, if you're traveling, especially in the United States, but not only in the United States, and you want to find out what's going on near you, the historical or what went on near you, the Historical Markers Database is very good. The one thing I would say is historical markers themselves tells you where the markers are. It doesn't necessarily tell you where the events or the places actually are. So the historical marker for Monticello, and I can see Monticello out my window right now, but the historical marker for Monticello is in downtown Charlottesville. It's 3 miles from here, so it's not all that close to Charlottesville. I found one last year for the home of Patrick Henry, the kind of Virginia revolutionary, and the marker was actually, it said 8 miles from here lived Patrick Henry.
Henry.
In his particular years. Henry. So these aren't necessarily
to the sites, they're just to the markers. Okay.
They're to the marker, not the site, but it's an interesting database. What about you?
My wife would hate me if I ever downloaded that app or whatever it is because I always read all the historical markers wherever we go, any place, and it drives her nuts. Because we were walking along and there's a sign for a historical plaque and I need to read it. I might get in trouble for that. I want to endorse at least the first episode of the new Star Trek Picard series. Now, again, this may have to do with celebrity and the sort of moment in time in which I was a teenager, but Star Trek Next Generation was really, really good. And I thought I had seen the end of these characters. After, I guess, Star Trek Nemesis, which wasn't the best of the Star Trek movies. At least some of the main or much of the main cast is back with this new Picard series. And I really enjoyed the first episode. They're sort of uploading new episodes every Friday, I guess. So looking forward to seeing episode 2 tomorrow. You have not had a chance to see it?
I've not seen it yet. I'm saving that for when I get back, but I too am looking forward to it. So I'm happy to hear that it's good. I'm really pleased to hear it's good.
It's if you're listening to this and you're a Star Trek nerd, you probably already like a Uber nerd. You've probably already seen it. But if you're a Star Trek fan, there's lots and lots of references to not only the Next Generation stuff, but a whole bunch of other Star Trek properties. But even if you haven't seen any of that, I think the story is intended to be something you can pick up from scratch too. But Patrick Stewart's an amazing actor, and I think he does a really at least the first episode was really well done. So
he's a very good actor.
Yes.
So David, are you a? Do you feel that you have to make a choice between Star Wars and Star Trek?
No, that's like choosing between your children. These are, or choosing between your parents or something. I don't know. They were both critically important, properties to me or pieces of culture when I was a kid, and they continue to be. I used to watch the original series when it was in sort of in syndication in, I guess when I was in middle school or something, and then the Next Generation came out, and that was amazing. And
Okay, I agree. I agree. I'm
yeah,
glad to hear that.
they're. I mean, they're not all good. So like Star Trek can be sometimes hit or miss. Like Star Wars can be kind of hit or miss. There's some of it that's really worth savoring, and then there's like Spock's brain.
Yes.
For those of you who remember that episode from season three of the original series. I think this is in the thus far in the good category of Star Trek, but we will see how it unfolds.
Excellent. Please do.
Right. Till next time.
All right,
Cheers.
David. See you next week. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.